I feel at home here at the seminary, yet at the same time somewhat out of place. I've been tucked away in secular universities my entire career at Arizona State, where I studied rather than, I did go to Grand Canyon College for 1 year before it became Grand Canyon University in Phoenix, a Southern Baptist college. So that brings me kind of, in a sense, to the root of all of that here at the seminary. But being in the secular world as a Christian has been interesting to find that my mentors, my teachers, have all encouraged me to study religious issues. And I didn't quite expect that. I don't know what I expected when I went to college. But all along the way, I've been encouraged and helped. They just wanted to see that I was studying the right way, using good method, good research practices. So I appreciate all that. And I'm bringing probably a different perspective here. I'm not a theologian, though I've had to study theology to be able to write about Whitfield. I'm not really an historian, though I did have a graduate level history research methods class that I knew I needed to study Whitfield. I've studied rhetoric. It's been the field. Some of you may not fully grasp what rhetoric is. It's not necessarily, though sometimes, what you step in out in the field. More technically, it's the study of persuasion. A statement by one of our leading professors in the field helped clarify it for me at some point. He said, aesthetics is the study of beauty. And its area of discourse are the arts, poetry, music, theater. Dialectic, and we heard Bruce talk about dialectic tensions, is a study of truth, two opposing views of truth, and we argue our way through it using dialectic method to come to truth. I think the study of theology really falls in that area. Its realm is the sciences, theology, the sciences in any form, rather. And the third area is rhetoric, which is a study of power. How do people influence one another? How are nations created? How does a king keep the people doing what they say without getting a revolution during his reign? How does a salesman influence you when you go to buy a new washing machine? And they're all using the practice of rhetoric. Sometimes the practice we call sophism, making the worst appear the better, lying, distorting, exaggerating, fallacious arguments, specious arguments. We've heard way too much of that. And then there's an honorable practice of rhetoric, genuine persuasion, ethical persuasion, good, solid argument, engaging your passions, because you won't do anything if you're not moved to do it. You'll sit there and agree, I'm with you, brother, but you won't get out of your seat and do anything until your passions are engaged. Whitfield was good at that. Homiletics falls under that kind of rhetorical heading. So it's really rhetoric is a study of homiletics. Homiletics is a very specialized type with its own conventions. But the principles are the same. And for young ministerial students, I would look around for courses in argumentation here at the school, the debate team. Does the school have a debate team here? I don't know. Be involved in these kinds of things, and you can start learning that rhetorical side of homiletics that I think you'll find very useful. So that's where I'm coming from, is the secular university system as a Christian hiding away there. And one of my colleagues was very concerned when he learned I had been on the Glenn Beck show at one point. But we get along pretty well. My study of George Whitfield began back about 1997, and I was sitting in my dissertation advisor's office at the University of Memphis, and we were talking about dissertation topics, and I digressed. And I told him a story about George Whitfield that I had read in Bushman's book on the Great Awakening. And my advisor sat back, folded his hands, and said, I think we've just found our dissertation topic. And I knew, he's right. I guess I'm passionate about this. And you need that passion to push you through writing a master's thesis or a dissertation. If you don't care about what you're writing about, it's going to be tough. And so that kind of began my study of George Whitefield, and I didn't know where it would lead. I didn't have a thesis yet for the project. And as I read more and more, I started noticing the political side of his ministry. Everything I'd read up to that point had been more about the ministerial side, but not his politics. I think there was a reason for that, is here in America, we tend to separate our religion and our politics. My father doesn't want me to talk about either when I go over to visit him. But we tend to do that, even though as Christians, we know that you can't separate them. But we still try to do that. But I think at that point, I still had that mentality that caused me to not quite notice how closely they were connected in my own life, in this community, and in George Whitefield's life. Well, so I'll dive into the manuscript here. I'm happy to send a copy to anybody that thinks it might be useful. I've titled this, Oops, Sorry About That Rebellion, Your Majesty. An unusual series of events started in 1741 after George Whitefield left New England all abuzz, revived, excited about God, with new converts seeking to live in the kingdom of God right there in Massachusetts. Even though New England had been revived, a number of leading ministers became upset about what happened. You'd think they'd be grateful, but why did the preachers resent the awakening? Why did they rush to print their opposition to the awakening as soon as Whitefield was out of town? Why didn't a bit of perspective and good teaching from these respected ministers not clear up the doctrinal issues? The short answer is that the disputes were not about doctrine. Political power, not religious doctrine, fueled the controversy surrounding the Great Awakening. There was no separation of church and state in the colonies and in England. The players involved did not recognize how deeply the awakening would affect the political and cultural development of the prospering colonies. Shifts in religion held a profound impact on the evolution of political thought, and shifts of emphasis in the ministry of George Whitefield enabled democratic ideas to go viral and plow the colonies into fertile ground for the Republican spirit. As we begin this analysis, let's consider a recent Supreme Court ruling in the U.S. that has prevented modern people from recognizing central aspects of colonial society. In 1947, Court Justice Hugo Black penned this fateful phrase. In the words of Jefferson, the clause against establishment of religion by law was intended to erect a wall of separation between church and state. Subsequent court opinions have cited this wall of separation, paving the way for the common public opinion we have today. Ironically, Black's cite of Jefferson referred to an 1801 letter to a friend, not the congressional record of discussion regarding the Bill of Rights in 1789, a discussion that Jefferson did not even attend. Jefferson's contribution occurred several years earlier in the form of a single sentence, albeit a 622-word Jeffersonian sentence that comprised Virginia's Act of Religious Freedom of 1786. By citing the private view of a single one of our founders, perhaps distorting it, modern courts have radically steered the nation in the direction the majority of founders would have opposed. Such is the nature of selective history. My point is that separation of church and state is a modern idea, especially in the absurd form it has taken, where a public school cannot put an angel on top of their Christmas tree. Its current practice is probably not one that our great-grandparents embraced, most assuredly not one that Americans of the early 1800s shared, and decidedly not one that a majority of founding fathers shared. The founders, including Jefferson, all agreed that religion helped to create good citizens. They just didn't want any single religion to be established. That means it receives tax money from the citizens. The issue Jefferson wrote about had to do with your tax money. Well, early on, your tax money can go to the church of your choice. And Jefferson finally came around and said, well, we shouldn't do this at all. We shouldn't have tax money go to churches at all. And I think most people think that was a wise decision. For George Whitefield in British society in 1741, there was no wall of separation. As a scholar, do not make the mistake of viewing people and events of a prior time in our history with the set of assumptions we live by today. When we grasp the nature of their worldview, when we see through their eyes, then their world starts to open up to us in a way that we couldn't see before. Church and state were joined at the hip in the 1740s. At a deeper structural level, yes, I'm a structuralist, religion and politics were indistinguishable. Only church members could hold office. Even the king swore allegiance to the 39 Articles, as I learned yesterday. And 26 of 46 Anglican bishops, if I'm not mistaken, were members of the House of Lords at that time. Our modern equivalent of the U.S. Senate, sort of. And that's pretty amazing. One of their main governing bodies are high churchmen, and they're making the laws of the land. So that's the depth to which in England the church was established. Massachusetts held that same depth with the Congregationalist Church. The Puritans, Congregationalists, are the same group. As the new lights emerged out of newly converted colonists in America, and as Methodism began to spread throughout England, the theological directions these new converts leaned would be the key to the political future. The established ministers throughout the empire intuitively sensed this, and with a bit of time for reflection, they explicitly wrote about it. Perhaps Whitefield first began to think about the connection between theology and political systems early in his career. As Jonathan Galf has argued, Whitefield's trips to Gibraltar, Ireland, and later Lisbon underscored his aversion to Roman Catholicism and provided him with images of what an England under papal control would look like. He probably also noted the oppression, the economic differences with England, and no doubt recognized the lurking presence of the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Yet Whitefield's public stances in America suggest that he didn't foresee trouble when he shook up the religious landscape. He was only 25, and when he ignored the orders of his Anglican bishops about where and when to preach, when he flaunted the directive to stop preaching by the Anglican commissary Alexander Garden in Charleston, these political churchmen took note of his disobedience and speculated where it might lead. At that time, George Whitefield was simply on a mission to preach the gospel to everyone in the British Empire. He covered much of England before 1739, covered the Americas by 1740, gave it a go in Ireland, and toured Scotland through 1741. Settling back into work in England, Whitefield labored to promote Methodism with the Wesleys. But everywhere he labored, he was met by ministers who opposed his work on both sides of the Atlantic. The issue at the root of this opposition finally made it into the light of day in 1743. Of course, that issue was politics, and it required Whitefield to grow up and recognize the depth and ramifications of his preaching. You see, it's sort of a red flag to go to politically minded folks when a newcomer can draw crowds of 30,000. I'm reminded of a scripture, Saul has slain thousands and David tens of thousands. Doesn't take John Locke to figure out where this is headed. So Whitefield left New England in an uproar and carried on his work in the British Isles, claiming the whole world is my parish, and nobody seemed able to stop him. But in 1743, somebody hired some thugs to get real serious at these Methodist meetings. The general disruptions we've heard a little bit about, including throwing pieces of dead cats and even people getting in trees behind Whitfield trying to urinate on him while he preached occurred. But those weren't necessarily violent in the form that they were about to take. William Seward, Whitfield's publicist, was killed. Somebody threw a stone and it hit him. Whitfield himself was dragged out of the meeting and thrown into a lime pit. I had to look it up. They used lime to throw on decomposing bodies in mass graves to keep the smell down and to help them decompose faster. Then they took him out and threw him into the creek to wash it off. It probably would really burn the skin. And I think at this point Whitfield said, enough is enough. And he took these people to court. He knew who they were, the people that actually drug him off. The attorney for the defense argued that Whitfield and the Methodists would infect the people. Infect, there's an interesting metaphor. It's one that suggests it was a particular viral idea that brought the danger. The lawyer concluded by claiming that it was right for any private person to try to stop them, and whoever did so was a friend to his country. Whitfield's attorney countered, "Rioters were not to be reformers, that His Majesty had nowhere put the reins of government into the hands of mobbers or made them judge or jury." Of course, the judge ruled for Whitfield, and he reminded the defendants of the dreadful ill consequences of rioting at such a critical time as this, that rioting was the forerunner of and might end in rebellion. By saying a critical time, the judge is referring to an impending war with France and a claim to the British throne by a Catholic heir from the Stuart lineage. Though the verdict was in and Whitfield and his friends were safer, the conflict was far from over. Whitfield targeted the source. An anonymous pamphlet was circulated among the upper classes in 1744, speculating that Whitfield's brand of religion would lead to trouble, like Britain experienced when Charles I was beheaded in 1644. But Whitfield no longer submitted meekly to abuse, going along with him to the lime pit. He counterpunched with a publicly released letter to the Bishop of London, which supplied evidence that local bishops authored the pamphlet, intending to represent the proceedings of the Methodists as dangerous to the church and state in order to procure an act of parliament against them. These kinds of fears were founded in reality. In his defense, Whitfield pointed out that the Methodists had not dissented, declaring them to be orthodox, well-meaning ministers and members of the Church of England and loyal subjects to His Majesty King George. Encountering any claim of personal disloyalty, Whitfield wrote, "I think it my duty to invite and preach to this rabble in all places where Providence shall send me at this season, that I may warn them against the dreadful effects of popish principles and exhort them to exert their utmost endeavors to keep out a popish pretender from ever sitting on the English throne." Whitfield wrote a follow-up letter and published it, sending it from the deck of a ship bound for America. His mission had expanded from simply preaching the gospel to preaching up loyalty to George II. He made good on that political shift for the rest of his career. It was George III that America rebelled against. George II ruled from 1718 until 1760, I believe, and Whitfield was in full support of him. Upon his arrival in America, the old established ministers leaped into action. Whitfield felt their fury as they opposed his planned meetings in Boston. His friends had been rattled by all the criticism and wanted to know where Whitfield stood. His opposers wrote editorials for the Boston papers and preached against him. But this was not the rash, overconfident Whitfield of the prior revival. He had learned to deal with criticism. He understood the underlying cause of concern, that doctrinal disputes were just a battleground, and the real conflict involved undermining of political authority in a church-state society. And since many of you here today are theologians and appreciate a good argument about theology, I'll digress for a little bit and suggest some food for thought. Hopefully you won't throw it at me in an hour. Though Whitfield claimed to be a Calvinist his entire life, we've seen good examples of that in the scholarship presented. He clarified his position on one occasion and suggested this: "Moderate Calvinism is a medium between two extremes. As you read his sermon text, we get some insight into what he may have meant. Whitfield exhorted his listeners to take action at the end of nearly every sermon. I think last night in our meeting in the chapel, some good examples of that from the sermon, What Think Ye of Christ? Whitfield wrote, come, poor, lost, undone sinner, just as you are to Christ. Yeah, I'm the heretic that put that line in the Wikipedia article, actually, though most of my ideas have been erased from there by others. That's a whole nother battleground. His next three quotes hint at God doing the hard part in salvation, but the sinner responding with some small part. This is from, I think, a sermon about Rebekah and Isaac. Whitfield said, shall I put that question to you, which Rebekah's relations, upon a proposal of marriage, put to her, will ye go with this man? This one's from Marriage of Cana. Our Lord is a God of justice as well as of love. And if sinners will not take hold of his golden scepter, verily he will bruise them with his iron rod. Again, may God influence your hearts to come to him. I am not willing to go away without persuading you. So in these statements, I see God doing the hard part, God making salvation possible in a good Calvinist system, but the sinner has some small action to take in that. And I think that's where he came up with the idea of a moderate Calvinism. If a sinner can act in some small but distinct way that enables or hastens salvation, then a sinner's free will is somehow part of the process. And this small step neatly solves the Puritan dilemma that Edmund Morgan wrote about, that just about killed Puritan congregationalism through attrition, because nobody was becoming a real Christian anymore, and their kids were moving off and starting their farms. Edwards had to say, well, folks, hang on to that thread with the spider. Hopefully God will save you. And Whitfield's telling people there's something you can do here. And they responded to that. So I can't label Whitfield an Arminian, sadly. But his example as the leading evangelist of America encouraged other true Arminian itinerants to take the next step and promote the free grace ideas of John Wesley. Thomas Clapp, who is the rector of Harvard University, said about Whitfield that separatists everywhere set Whitfield up as their oracle, pattern, and patron. And there were a lot of other people that were mimicking Whitfield and going out and itinerating. It was a social movement that encompassed most of the colonies. And it wasn't just Whitfield that was traveling around. A lot of ministers were going out across the colonies, leaning more in an Arminian direction. And that can be very profound when we recognize that politics and religion can't be separated in a thinking person's mind. A worldview, I'm still digressing into theology here, a worldview underpinned by Calvinist theology, where a radically sovereign God solely determines if, when, and how you receive salvation, fits hand in hand, forms a natural foundation for a political ideology that supports a strong king with absolute authority in a nation. On the other hand, a worldview underpinned by Arminian theology, where a sinner possesses partial agency in salvation, fits hand in hand and forms a natural foundation for a political ideology that supports a democratic form of government, say where citizens have a vote. You can't separate religion and politics, and until 1783, nobody ever really tried. And I don't think they really tried to separate them even then. Maybe Jefferson had some ideas that way. But most of our founders did not. Whitfield's messages were clearly undermining the authority of old light ministers who sought to maintain control of the religious nature of the growing colonies. By extension, he was undermining the authority of government officials. He suggested that new converts insist that their minister had the new birth, He implied they ought to leave their old light congregations and find new light churches that taught the new birth if they were in a dead church with a unsaved minister. This subtle shift in theology, well, not so subtle, provided a worldview then that could reject the monarchy, that could reject governments if they weren't doing what they were supposed to do. And when the Republican ideas started sweeping through the American colonies in the later 1760s and 1770s, this all started to become very important. Okay, so Whitfield arrived in Boston, received with opposition led by Charles Chauncey. He pointed out the following: Whitfield introduced disorder and confusion into the Church of God. He accused Whitfield of neglecting his own parish in Georgia with itinerancy and complained that the entire dissolution of our church state would occur should this practice become more generalized. Church state is a phrase we start hearing a lot from Puritans if you read their writings. Chauncey even promoted one of America's first conspiracy theories that we heard about last night in our talk, that there's a design carrying on to subvert and eject the standing settled ministers. And Thomas Clapp, the rector of Harvard, again explained that it was the ministers from Scotland, Ireland, and even Whitfield's orphanage, Bethesda, that would replace the standing ministers in New England, and even the governors would be changed. He said that there was a rumor going around Yale to the students that were expelled for enthusiasm, being too charismatic. And they were told there's no danger in disobeying their present governors because there would in a short time be a great change in the civil government. Whitfield responded decisively as soon as he figured out what was going on. He admitted he was wrong on several issues and apologized. That's always a good strategy. He held his ground on theology, and he totally denied being part of any plot to change the government. But I think the most consequential thing he did during this debate, and it's all written out in several treatises, was this following statement in his published reply to Chauncey: "That I spake of unconverted ministers in the lump as Pharisees, enemies of Christ Jesus, and the worst enemies I had, I believe is true. But that I spake of the ministers of New England in this way, I utterly deny." Whitfield didn't avoid conflict. But in this statement, he maintains his distinction between converted and unconverted ministers, but he concedes that the New England ministers have the new birth, just a different kind than the new birth he had. And so he expands a little bit ambiguously how the new birth can occur. And I think with this move, he started a reconciliation process. They were still mad at him, and he left town, and things weren't settled. But there was a meeting called the Convention of New England Ministers. It's kind of sketchy in the newspaper records, but there's mention of it a couple times, and I was looking for anything published about it, and all I could find was another newspaper article said that they had the meeting and these people attended, and I think there were about 26 to 40 ministers who attended. But the purpose was for them to talk about the divisions, and there were old lights and new lights that met. And I'd love to find some notes from that meeting, but haven't found those yet. Whitfield moved to the middle, and as the oracle, pattern, and patron of the separatists, this move set an example for other pro-revivalists, and they started muting their criticism of old light ministers. So don't miss the symbolic importance of that public controversy. We had a style of religion Whitfield was promoting that weakened authoritarianism, and it strengthened human agency, and which led to a democratic impulse. But in the midst of all this, Whitfield found a way to say to the old lights and new lights, we're still brothers. You're Christians, we're Christians. And as we learned an hour ago, minimizing the theological differences and maximizing their brotherhood in Christ. I think this helped unite American religion after the Awakening. It took a few years, and ministers recognized, and some of the old lights wrote, that, yeah, the Awakening had been good for everybody. Our churches are full again. And the church-state society had not been overthrown. Thomas Clapp even welcomed Whitfield to Harvard about 10 years later. And so it took a little while, but they forgave each other and recognized they were on the same side. After the public controversy, Whitfield went back to England, and war with France was upon him. And, well, we're still in 1746, and Boston decided to send an army up to Louisbourg, which is in Nova Scotia. There was a port there that had been supplying French ships, which had been attacking and seizing British ships on the Atlantic. And they wanted to shut down their base of operation there, so they sent up about 600 men. They asked Whitfield to go up as the chaplain, and he didn't want to. He didn't like war. But he did write an enlistment sermon motivating people to sign up and go on the expedition. And they went up and they took the fort. Sad part of the story is about two-thirds of the army died that winter. They took the fort with no casualties. But two-thirds of the men died from cold and sickness, and they just were not provisioned well enough to hold on to things. But this was quite a change for somebody to preach an enlistment sermon for the military. Can you imagine that today? And he was doing this at the request of the governor of Massachusetts. Whitfield had expanded his ministry, and he remarked on the change and said, "I hope I shall always think it my bounded duty, next to inviting sinners to the blessed Jesus, to exhort my hearers to exert themselves against the first approaches of popish tyranny and arbitrary power." You'll see that term, arbitrary power, throughout colonial revolutionary literature in the 1770s. British ministers just oppressing people, doing things arbitrarily, just to show everybody who's in control here. Later that year, Bonnie Prince Charles made his move in the Second Jacobite Rebellion. He arrived in Scotland, gained Scottish recruits, marched an army south to Derby that nearly drove George II out of town in London, and the Jacobites didn't find the support levels they expected. They retreated to Scotland to regroup. The French were disappointed and pulled back some of their support, and it was a fatal error for them, and Britain recalled the Duke of Cumberland from Europe and organized a much stronger army to face them this time, and they went and decisively defeated the Scots. And it's probably why my Highland family ended up in America. A lot of Scots were deported at that time that weren't outright killed at the battle. And as they were getting deported to America, Whitfield was over there still preaching, and he stepped up to support the government again with a sermon and a political ideology for these Scots to consider. Whitfield's sermon, "Britain's Mercies and Britain's Duties," connects the French, papism, and the Antichrist in a horrid plot, first hatched in hell and afterwards nursed in Rome. And he wanted the Scots to know, you were fighting for King Charles, or not King Charles, Bonnie Prince Charles, the Stuarts, and here's who you were really fighting for, not for God in this case. So this political struggle over Europe, the riches of America, ended up being cast in millennial terms. I've argued elsewhere this particular sermon was the first one I've found that talks about war and millennialism in this way. But Nathan Hatch wrote a really good book talking about the religious motives for the British Empire to fight the French between 1756 and 1763. And you see these civil millennialism themes throughout sermons and writings of the 1770s in the colonies in America after they declared independence. By 1748, Whitfield had become the chaplain of a countess. The decision solidly aligned him with Whig interests in England and gave him political connections that would serve him well as the future unfolded. By 1756, Whitfield accepted an invitation to preach in a London meeting house called Longacre. But Dr. Zachary Pierce, the Bishop of Bangor, wrote Whitfield and forbade him to minister at Longacre, claiming he wasn't licensed to preach there. Same old conflict is back. Whitfield knew how to handle this kind of harassment, as he'd been doing for years, and he sent a letter back to the bishop arguing for the legality of his preaching. Pierce held firm, and their debate took an ugly turn. Whitfield wrote him and said, "Controversy, my lord, is what I abhor, especially at this juncture, when France and Rome and hell ought to be the common butt of our resentment. I trust the irregularity I am charged with will appear justifiable to every true lover of English liberty." The bishop wasn't convinced, and the thugs came back, started disrupting the meetings with lots of noise to start, and then they started throwing rocks through the church windows, fist-sized rocks, and they would hit the people inside, and some people were injured. And Whitfield threatened the bishop to publish everything publicly and take them to court. And the bishop said, "I have the upper-class right as a member of the House of Lords that you can't publish any of my letters publicly." And the intimidation even increased after that point. And so Whitfield wrote to some friends of his that he had met through the Countess of Huntington, several people, and apparently these connections with powerful people made the difference. They intervened, and pressure was applied from above, and Bishop Pierce called off his dogs. Whitfield mused to a friend about the deeper issue involved, though. "Our cause, in my opinion, is the cause of God and the cause of civil and religious liberty." Whitfield was, early in his career, talked about the religious liberties from the Act of Toleration of 1689, but as he matured, it became civil and religious liberties, usually tied together from about this point in the 1750s on through the end of his life. Later that year, Whitfield published another enlistment sermon for the war against the French, a short address to persons of all denominations. Here he revived civil millennial themes and told his hearers they would incur the curse of morose if they wouldn't support the war effort. It's a verse from Judges where the prophetess Deborah says to the Israelites, "Curse ye morose, for you did not go out against to aid the Lord against the mighty." And Nathan Whitaker preached a very powerful sermon on this, or he wrote it and sent it to George Washington to read to the men at Valley Forge. And George Washington heartily thanked him for that sermon, but he really expounds there that if you don't go out and fight, God's curse is going to be on you, and you don't want that. After the war with the French ended, I've skipped ahead about 7 years, Whitfield continued to face Anglican opposition to his ministry. In the American colonies, their missionary branch, known as the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts, known as the SPG, they had ratcheted up their efforts to strengthen their denomination in America. The Anglicans were weak in America. There were some parishes, and they did a lot of good work. They built schools, libraries, but really they were strengthening Anglicanism, and that was a concern to the New England Puritans and a lot of other American church leaders. And they feared that if the Anglicans get established in America the way they were established in Great Britain, and, you know, in 1765, why wouldn't you think that? Independence wasn't really the fore of discussion yet. They were still part of England, and everybody wanted the problems to settle down. They thought that if the Anglicans get established, they would appoint a bishop. That would be the key point. Once they appoint a bishop here, we're in trouble. They expected ecclesiastical courts, mandatory tithing, Anglican political appointees would follow that. And all of these practices were customary in England, but it smelled like arbitrary power to the colonial leaders. So when Whitfield returned to America in 1764, he became more aware of the SPG's controversial activities. They'd been ebbing and flowing for a decade or so. But also the Grenville program was getting underway, and this was a program from the British government to raise money from England and the colonies, all of her colonies, to pay for the war. They were in debt, and to pay for a continued garrisoning of troops in the Americas. Whitfield knew some details about the program that the colonists didn't know. And in 1764, he met with two Puritan ministers in New Hampshire who had been active in opposing the SPG. Later, they would be Whig revolutionary leaders, Samuel Davies and Samuel Langdon. And Whitfield informed them of the Tory intentions wrapped up in the Grenville Plan. "I can't in good conscience leave the town without acquainting you with a secret. My heart bleeds for America. Oh, poor New England. There is a deep-laid plot against both your civil and religious liberties, and they will be lost. Your golden days are at an end. You have nothing but trouble before you. My information comes from the best authority in Great Britain. I was allowed to speak of the affair in general, but enjoined not to mention particulars." I imagine this news traveled pretty fast. I imagine Whitfield met with religious leaders throughout that tour of the colonies, told them the same things. And I imagine the religious leaders talked to each other about it. Langdon publicized this, and they speculated that this plot would include a general taxation of the colonies. They were right about that. Alteration of the chartered governments. I don't think they quite got there. The introduction of Church of England bishops, tithes for the support of Church of England clergy, and public offices only for Church of England members. And these last three items really revolted the colonial leaders. Each of these acts were acts of arbitrary power to the colonists and were resoundingly condemned by ministers and political leaders. Parliament passed the Sugar Act in 1764, the Stamp Act in 1765, and this provided the evidence of the plot, and the colonies were pushed into an uproar. And we don't need to say much about that chapter of American history. So Whitfield left America in 1765, and as he left, he was contacted by Samuel Adams. And he was a prolific New England activist. Was he a cousin of John Adams, I believe? Puritan, New England Puritan. I don't think he made beer. And Adams asked him to take advantage of his connections with the British nobility on behalf of the colonies and wrote, "It would add very great weight to the cause of distressed American subjects if their circumstances could be fully known to a nobleman of his lordship's great integrity and understanding." Within two different letters, Adams summarized the Americans' perspective of the crisis around the Stamp Act, and he also lists the most effective arguments one would need for speaking against it, were they inclined to do so. So Adams hints that the colonies might be forced to pursue independence if England shall exert her power to destroy their liberties. In addition to whatever private conversations Whitfield may have conducted by Adams' request with friends in England, his presence with Ben Franklin before Parliament made an unmistakable statement. Whitfield, a symbol of the public mind in America, had embraced the cause of the colonists. The Stamp Act was overturned in 1766, causing Whitfield to write in his journal, March 16, 1766, "Stamp Act repealed. Gloria Deo." Nathaniel Whitaker, a colonial leader, recalled that Whitfield was greatly concerned for the liberties of America and that the decision was in no small measure owing to him. Though repeal of the Stamp Act calmed things down for a while, the SPG started pushing for their bishop again, and that roused the Americans once more. And it didn't help the SPG that 11 bishops in the House of Lords opposed repeal of the Stamp Act. By 1766, many Americans made no distinction between religious or civil liberties. Liberty itself faced extinction, according to Charles Chauncey. And colonial ministers marshaled the defense through the renewed opposition to the bishop issue. Whitfield was well aware of these issues. When he wrote to Archbishop Secker in 1767, he said, "I fear it will follow that a society which since its first institution hath been looked upon as a society for propagating the gospel, hath been all the while rather a society for propagating episcopacy in foreign parts. And if so, how it must increase the prejudices of our colonists, both in the islands and on the continent, against the establishment of episcopacy. In one sense, Whitfield was an Anglican, you know, and he publicly he needed to support the establishment of a bishop, but not the way you're doing it. And he was trying to make them aware of the problems. And he said this in the midst of his efforts to convert or to start a college in Georgia to train ministers. And as somebody said, it would be the Harvard of the South, sort of, if Whitfield's plan had worked. But the Archbishop opposed that, and I'm reading through my notes here. Secker was unwilling to let Whitfield start this college, which was going to train ministers, train future thinkers and leaders, and he wanted it to be under Anglican control. And Whitfield didn't. It was to be, as you heard, a broad-based organization, and it was funded by dissenters and separatists, and it would have a different kind of teaching there than the Anglicans. And they're really struggling over control of the future minds of our leaders throughout the southern colonies of England. And it wasn't just about, we want to be in control of the college. It's a lot deeper than that. And, you know, religion and politics are still connected together here. So Whitfield took the American side in this conflict, and he withdrew his request to establish a public academy to serve all the people of Georgia. Oh, instead, he sought to just establish a school, more of a high school type, to serve all the people, but it wouldn't train ministers. But it was more of a, we're just going to teach the citizens. We start getting to a more egalitarian, we're not just training upper classes here. We'll teach everybody. The meta message in this announcement was not lost on the colonists. Though a loyal Anglican, Whitfield continued to resist arbitrary control over his projects. He let go of a personal dream instead of betraying his dissenting supporters. And ultimately, the colonists interpreted Whitfield's personal clash with Secker within a larger scope of Anglican control of the colonial religious scene in general. Okay, what are we to make of the politics of George Whitfield? He ministered in a time and place where religion and politics were firmly linked openly, unlike our modern insistence that the wall of separation keeps religion out of politics. By age 25, Whitfield recognized the link in practical ways. He adapted his ministry to survive. He praised George II for his efforts to preserve religious liberty. But these kind of accolades for George III are conspicuously missing from Whitfield's writings. Sometimes what you don't say speaks loudly. Instead, Whitfield's struggles with the Anglicans, perhaps this was a proxy attack on the monarchy, if you're inclined to read it that way. So here today, I think what we learn from Whitfield and what we can take away from his experiences there was to take the business of theology very seriously, as Whitfield did. We're not simply studying footnotes of religious history. We're learning about deep structures of human behavior, of how communities of people that share a language and a culture, how they live together. You're studying stuff that makes people tick. It determines whether communities survive or not. The theological foundations under your own teachings will have great influence on people that accept you as a mentor. So take the responsibility very seriously. Learn your lessons well. You've got to learn to refute Arminians like me. But recognize the ramifications of where that can go. You don't know where your teachings will take other people. And what they do with these ideas may surprise even you, like I think it did Whitfield. If Whitfield had lived longer, I suspect he may have been horrified at the turn of events through the 1770s. Maybe God was merciful, taking him before the war swept across the Americas. Well, I hope to see you all again in 2070, the year 2070, for a conference memorializing the 300th anniversary of George Whitefield's passing. For those of us unable to meet here at the Andrew Fuller Center for Baptist Studies 64th annual conference, we'll have our own meeting in the Kingdom of Heaven, and perhaps we can arrange to have a plenary speaker, a certain preacher who may bring us to tears. Thank you.
Well, again, we have some time for some questions on what I think is a very, very important subject, the intersection of theology, religion, and the political scene.
Thank you so much. That was very engaging and provoking. Just a point of clarification. Toward the end, I heard you saying things about the importance of theology and how it matters. But I noticed a couple of points in your presentation, you use language more on the order of the outward appearance was of a theological conflict, but the real conflict was political. Could you comment on that? It seems to me that that language downplays the theological ideas that at the end you come back to say really drove him.
I think we're one level maybe above another, but upon reflection, maybe it's this way, and in 5 years, I may say, no, it's like this. I think in the final analysis, I think religion is primal in the human experience. Our relationship with God is established first in some way. The first of the Ten Commandments have to do with the relationship with God, and the latter commandments have to do with relationships with people. I think God put them in that order for a reason. So probably have to say that religion is the chicken that lays the egg, if you will, and I'll put the chicken first there to answer that old question. People argue about, and they fight, they have conflict about issues, and often those issues are what are on the surface, and so we're arguing about political power here in the colonies. Perhaps, and we teach in the conflict mediation field, usually relationships are at the heart of those conflicts, and you can't solve them until you get down to the relationship level. But we initially start arguing over the topics of conflict rather than the nature of the relationship between people. So maybe I need to do some more thought on that and reword how I say things in this kind of research to try to clarify.
To what degree do you think his upbringing and life as a working, being born in an inn and working, sort of a working class lad, we might put it, would have contributed to his understanding of power and how he would have responded to that at a later point that you're bringing up in his life?
I think some historians have made some assumptions about that working in the inn. It was the family business. I liked what was said about his entrepreneurial spirit that pervaded his ministry. But yes, he was a working person. I'm sure he had to change sheets and clean rooms and do a lot of menial tasks at the family inn. And then as he entered Oxford, he entered as a servitor. He was a servant to some wealthier students and that paid his tuition and his room and board at Oxford and allowed him to study. And so he was probably treated badly by these upper class, or I say upper class in the sense of the sons of wealthy, the British nobility and the wealthy class. And he had to cook for them. He had to clean their rooms and do what they told him to do. And so I think he had a strong identification with the commoners of England. They were divided into the commoners and then the nobility. So, sure, I think that he just identified more with the working class, the tradesmen, the people that did the labor than he would the upper classes. Whitfield was an enigma much of his life. He has this lower class background, but he's the chaplain to a countess. And many of you read about the corner of the countess's drawing room where he preached to the upper classes, and bishops would sneak in and hide behind a curtain to listen to his sermons. But he became acquainted with a lot of people pretty high up the chain in England, and was very social with them, conversed well with them. Does that answer your question? Well, he became a Whig. I think that's why. So I don't think we can say he was a revolutionary, but definitely in England he supported the Whig causes and the lords that are mentioned with him, Lord Bolingbroke, and there's another one I can't remember right now, I think were notorious Whigs.
You mentioned how he pulled political levers and how he preached enlistment sermons. How aware was he, how conscious was he of his political power? Or was it an after effect of a man seeking to see people born again, the new birth? So how aware was he of his political influence?
I think he was explicitly and consciously aware of what he was doing with the enlistment sermons. They needed soldiers for the army. People needed to sign up. And he understood the stakes of that. And I think by this point in his life, he understood, I need to support the king. And if I don't take that public stance of supporting the monarchy, even though he was a Whig, and of course, as you know, the Whigs wanted a strong parliament in England, a more Republican influence, and the Tories wanted the strong king who had more authoritarian power. And George II let parliament run the country to a much greater degree. George III tried to take power back away from parliament, and that's where there was quite a struggle in Great Britain over who was in power. Which spilled over to the colonies, and that's why the arbitrary power and the oppression started in the colonies under George III. So I think Whitfield knew very well he was supporting George II and the war efforts under George II's reign, and wanted to, and he may have thought this would keep him from getting killed at some point as well, to be in that direct support of the monarchy.
It appears this establishment of the Anglican bishoprics was in play in Virginia, where Baptists in the colonial period had a very hard struggle for religious liberty because of the church-state concept. In Virginia, many Baptists were imprisoned, very close to the Revolutionary War. I know that Whitfield had a big stake in supporting religious liberty in Virginia, particularly in the cause of Samuel Davies. Have you studied any around that, and how that had an effect on the cause of religious liberty in America with the ensuing war effort and everything, and the Bill of Rights which followed?
I'm not as well studied on the particular denominations. You know, obviously the Puritans were established in New England. Other colonies had a dominant church, the Presbyterians in New Jersey, Quakers in Pennsylvania, if anybody. What Jefferson wrote, the act of religious toleration, I'm confusing it. His act of 1786, the 622-word sentence, really tried to say that we can't have any one church supported by tax money, and we need to not have any church supported by the tax money or be established in any of the colonies. Other colonies passed their own legislation that established, or often you can give your tax money for the church to the church of your choice. That's often how the law, I think in New York it was passed that way. So if you're a Baptist, your tithe, and the tithe went through the government to the church, would go to the Baptists. And if you're Anglican, it would go to the Anglicans. And so that was kind of a middle ground, and then Jefferson came along and said, let's just not do that at all. Did that answer your question, Dan?
It didn't really happen that way in Massachusetts, because Isaac Backus really fought that, because Baptists, his big issue was Baptists
yeah.
supporting Puritan Congregationalist
right.
ministers.
Their tax money was going to the Puritans, yeah. So Massachusetts, the Puritans had quite a stronghold there at that time, and there was a lot of controversy in Massachusetts with the Baptists especially.
So one last question.
I've been allowed the microphone as long as I don't speak on behalf of the Crown.
Straighten me out.
In 2070, I will be 98, so I don't know if I'll be here or not. But you are speculating that some of us will be quite old. If George had lived another 100 years, it's a slightly cheeky question, but which side would he have been on in Lincoln's war of Northern aggression and constitutional suppression? That is, somebody ought to say something about his views of slavery, and you seem the best man to address that.
Next question. I will say then, had Whitfield been just continued to live, first of all, I think he would have stayed in England. At some point, I think he would have kept going back to America, and I think he would have taken up the activist causes that were going on throughout the colonies, even suffrage, perhaps, at some point. Women ministers were very common at one point in American history, and then that was suppressed. And I think he encouraged women to be involved in ministry. And I think for slavery, he probably would have been persuaded by William Wilberforce to oppose it and would have been active in the colonies to oppose slavery. I've also read, though, that the Civil War is a banker's war. Slavery was an issue, but not the real driving force behind the war. But that's another lecture, and I'll let an historian handle that one. So I think he would have taken on the activist causes. And he was very good at riding the fence, staying in the middle between opposing factions in religion and in politics. And he probably would have done it in a way that kept him in the good graces of people in power when he was opposing them. Well, that's my speculation. I speculate a lot.
That's again show our appreciation. Thank you.
Thank you.